a prophet without honor. When Jesus had finished these parables, he moved on from there. Coming to his hometown, he began teaching the people in their synagogue, and they were amazed. "Where did this man get this wisdom and these miraculous powers?" they asked. "Isn't this the carpenter's son? Isn't his mother's name Mary? And aren't his brothers James, Joseph, Simon, and Judas? Aren't all his sisters with us? Where then did this man get all of these things?" And they took offense at him. But Jesus said to them, "Only in his hometown and in his own home is a prophet without honor." And he did not do many miracles there because of their lack of faith.
Over the last couple of weeks, we've looked at the parables of Jesus here in chapter 13 of Matthew. And just before Jesus began to tell these parables, at the end of chapter 12, his mother and his brothers come wherever he is there in Galilee, and they want to speak to him. Evidently, they want to rein him in. What they're hearing makes them uncomfortable. Maybe they think that he's out of his depth, or that he's going to get himself in trouble. The Gospel of Mark tells us that they thought he was out of his mind. It's difficult for the average person to believe in Jesus. Think how hard it must have been if he was the child that you'd cleaned and diapered, or the brother who would fling peas at you off of the end of a spoon at supper time, or something like that. It would have been very difficult to change your expectations of Jesus. It's human nature to develop expectations and maybe even stereotypes of other people. I was thinking about this recently. I was at a workshop, and the presenter in the workshop was having difficulty with the video projector, just couldn't quite figure out the remote control. So this lady handed the remote control to somebody in the audience, and they took it and fooled with it, and they obviously couldn't figure out what to do with it. And then they handed it on to this elderly gentleman that was sitting there in the audience, and he kind of took the remote control, and he turned it over in his hands like this and looked at it, and I noticed a few younger people around me kind of smiled and chuckled about that. Because, you know, there's kind of a stereotype, right? If you want somebody to help you with the high-tech gear, you look for the youngest person in the room. Yeah, you know, you see the three-year-olds thumbing through the iPhones these days. But when I saw them pass the remote to this older fellow, I didn't laugh because I'd gotten to know this guy a little bit. I'd been paired with him at an earlier workshop and sat and had some conversation with him. And at one point during the conversation, I'd asked him, what did you do before you retired? And he said, "Well, I was a scientist." And I said, "Yeah, and who did you work for?" "Well, I was a scientist. I worked for the United States government." So I was puzzled, what kind of work did you do there? And he said, "Well, did you ever watch those James Bond movies?" And I said, "Yeah, I've seen those." He said, "You know the character Q in those movies?" Now, Q in the James Bond movies is the scientist in the lab coat who's always inventing some kind of new gadget, spy gadget, like the broom that turns into a radio, or the car that turns into a submarine, or something like that. And I said, "Yeah, I've seen the Q." I said, "Well, that's what I did." So he had done those kinds of things. We went on and had some interesting conversations. And he was able to get that projector going very rapidly. They had handed the remote control to the right guy. You know, when people violate the expectations that we have of them, we don't know what to do about it. It's kind of confounding to us. We're either reluctant to accept them, or sometimes we just outright reject them, because they don't fit the expectations that we have of them. Matter of fact, it may be more difficult to accept new ideas and new ways of doing things from people that we know very well than it is from people that we barely know at all. And that's kind of ironic, isn't it? Because you'd think that we would, knowing someone well, would create a higher level of trust in that person. But it seems sometimes that if it violates our sense of expectations of that person and their place, perhaps, among us. And sometimes it can actually create distrust when the person seems to be violating those expectations. And then that's true for churches as well. I wonder if that's one of the reasons churches sometimes struggle to pass on the responsibilities within the church, pass on leadership within a church onto the next generation, onto younger people. I've been very pleased over the years at this congregation because the elders and ministers of this congregation have seemed to kind of recognize that. And I think that now as well we recognize that's one of the major tasks, the most important things about our life together right now. How do we pass on the responsibilities and leadership to younger people? In healthy congregations, just like in healthy families, generations work together. Each seeks the best for the other. There's no competition there. There's just mutual love and respect, and hopefully, as it develops, trust. So we need to trust those people who are younger, and we need to trust them even when they don't do things the way that we would do them. If we refuse to accept anything being done because it's not the way we would do it or the way that we did it, well, what does that say? And what does that kind of doom us to? I think it dooms any group of people to never changing and no progress. And, you know, probably the thing that's most threatening, and perhaps this is what's going on here in this passage with Jesus in his hometown, is that when anyone, someone younger or someone older that's a part of our group, goes out in faith on a limb in their life, there are implications for the rest of the group. It can be very, very threatening because it means that if that person is right, then where should we be? We should be out on the limb in faith too. And I think that's why it's so very challenging. And maybe that's what's kind of happening here and the feel that the folks in Jesus' hometown of Nazareth are having about them. He starts teaching in the synagogue. And notice it's the teaching, not necessarily the miracles, that put them over the edge. He's got the audacity to tell us that we need to change. Do we need to do anything differently? The words and the works that create faith, for some people, create distrust in the people who should know him best. And in a small town like that, probably 500 people or no more, most everybody probably felt like they knew Jesus plenty well. There are very little that they felt like they didn't know about him. And I think in our life, knowing a lot about Jesus without obeying him is probably the very worst combination of all. You think you know what Jesus is all about, and so you become desensitized to just how much Christ is calling you to change. And when something comes along that doesn't fit into what you've always believed, you'll just write it off. Now, the statement that Jesus makes about a prophet not being without honor except in his own hometown, that's probably a well-known proverb of the day. They would have recognized it. He was not the first prophet to get run out of his hometown. He was not going to be the last prophet to get run out of his hometown. And I think it could be a tendency that we have to think that, well, if people run us out of town, then somehow that means we're doing something right. Well, just because people are offended by what you say doesn't mean that you're a prophet. Well, we need to say that, of course. You may just be offensive, okay? You shouldn't use that as an excuse for being rude in any way. But we also need to look at the other side of that. We need to remember that opposition from this world, and even at times from our brothers and sisters in Christ, in the church, is not always an indicator that we're going against the will of God. If you are pursuing the new creation that God has begun in Jesus Christ and God continues to do through the Spirit, if you are humble, if you consider the opposition that you face prayerfully and honestly, then what you might discover is that the opposition you face may be due to the fact that people are so heavily invested in the world as it is, including here in the church, that they can't see another way. This violates their expectations. You put your trust in the ways of Jesus, and don't you think folks who are invested up to their eyebrows in the old way of doing things in this world are going to have a problem with you? So if you see it this way, maybe opposition could be an encouragement even. Although it doesn't seem that that's the way Jesus feels when he heads out of town. And he did not do many miracles there because of their lack of faith. Now, does that mean that God's power is limited? Is our belief somehow necessary to unlock God's power? Or if you pray and you don't get what you ask for, does that mean that you didn't have faith? I've heard it used for, you know, all of those things people have talked about. But you know, we need to remind ourselves the New Testament never looks at God as being limited in power. Remember one of the more poignant episodes, I think, that illustrates that. Jesus is talking to his disciples in the garden, and they want to rescue him by force. And Jesus says, "Don't you know I could have called 10,000 angels and God would have rescued me?" Jesus could have asked God. God would have rescued him, he reminds them. So why doesn't Jesus ask God to rescue him there? I think the reason Jesus couldn't do this or wouldn't do this is that doing this any other way would require a very different God. The God that we know in Jesus doesn't use power that way. Even if it's the way that, you know, we would do it, God must be true to God's own character. That doesn't make God ineffective or not all-powerful. In a sense, God couldn't rescue Jesus in that way and be true to God's own power. In the same way, maybe Jesus didn't do many miracles in his hometown because it was not in his character to coerce belief. And maybe Jesus didn't do many miracles there because to do so with a group of people whose ideas about him were so distorted would create even more misunderstanding. Perhaps it could even be a loving thing to do, not to do miracles in this situation, if it's going to create more misunderstanding among them. He didn't want to be seen just as a musician, a magician, just a miracle worker. He was trying to create real faith. Jesus sometimes does miracles to evidence his power, turns water to wine. Sometimes he does miracles surely out of sheer compassion. He reaches out and touches a leper when a word would have done it. He also sometimes does miracles when it doesn't look like it's in his own best interests. Remember back at the end of chapter 9, we talked about a couple of weeks ago, when Jesus healed two blind men, and he took them inside the house to heal them, and he told them not to tell anybody what he had done. But they did go out and they told. And did it create faith? Well, we might read it today and say, well, it creates faith in me to see that Jesus could heal blind people. But in the story, in the way Matthew tells the story, that's when things start to go south in Galilee. That's when the opposition starts to heat up. That's when his mother and his brothers come to get him. And they couldn't even stand it. So Jesus isn't trying to use reverse psychology on these two blind men. He's more than a miracle worker. He does not want those who are representing him to misrepresent him, because he does not want to be rejected for what he is not. So when Jesus looks over his shoulder on his way out of his hometown there for the last time, as far as we know, and he sees his skeptical mother, his unbelieving brothers and sisters, the neighbors behind them muttering good riddance under their breath, wouldn't that have been incredibly discouraging? He was being rejected by the people who should have known him best. All his disciples must have thought, if not here, then where? If not with these folks, then with who? And soon all of this is going to come crashing down on them. He's going to go to Jerusalem. He'll go to the cross. His mother will be there weeping bitterly. His brothers, I'm sure, were just shaking their head. What a waste. But of course, we know the story, and God is faithful and raises Jesus from death. And after his resurrection, he appears to his mother and to his brothers, and they believe. And some of them go on to become very great leaders in the church, to give their own lives as disciples for the cause of Christ. So faith is not unimportant. Faith is very important on our part. There is a famous sculpture in Milan. I want to show you a picture here. It's called the Rondanini Pieta. And this is a portrayal, of course. A Pieta is a sculpture of Jesus, of Mary holding her son Jesus, the body of her crucified son. And there are many Pietas. It's hard to see what is so, you know, famous or remarkable about this sculpture, because it looks pretty unrefined, fairly crude. But it's actually the work of the very same artist who did the extraordinary statue of David and painted the Sistine Chapel. This is work of Michelangelo. And Michelangelo was working on this piece the day that he died. And he'd been working on it for 10 years, off and on. The day he died, one of his assistants preserved it. You'll notice at the front of the sculpture here, hanging down a disembodied arm. It's the arm of Jesus from the sculpture, in the way that the artist initially envisioned it. Contemporaries of his who watched him work on this sculpture said that he had a lot of trouble with this stone, that the stone was full of impurities and that it was extremely hard. And they said that as he worked on it, sparks flew from under his chisel. So the stone itself had flaws. But he never gave up working on it, though it didn't appear as he envisioned that it would. God is an artist. And God has a vision for what our lives should be. God chips away at everything in our lives that's not the image of Christ, and we can either submit to the artist, have faith, or we can resist, not have faith. As we submit, the life of Jesus emerges within us. But if we continue to resist, there may come a day when God is just finally going to let the stone be stone. C.S. Lewis once said that in the end there will be only two kinds of people: those who say to God, "Thy will be done," and those to whom God says, "Okay, go ahead and have it your way." Christ seeks to create faith in us, and there are severe consequences for failing to have faith. And we've focused only on perhaps this idea of hell or heaven. It's hard to understand. But I think the New Testament and the Gospels and Jesus make clear that the primary consequence of rejection of Jesus and failure to have faith in him is that we do not become who he meant us to be. We don't understand, perhaps, how truly horrible that failure would be. At the most basic level in this story, the folks in Jesus' hometown were offended by Jesus' humanity, the fact that he had a family. Isn't this Joseph, the carpenter's son? Isn't this the brother of James and Joseph? And he's got a family right here among us. And isn't it true that we, as Jesus' family, the church, continue to either be true witnesses to who he is, or perhaps obstacles to true faith? Probably most of the time we spend, we're a mixture of both of those things. When people see us, but they don't get the true picture of the life Jesus would have us live in this world, it distorts the truth. And Jesus does not want people to believe in him based on a misrepresentation of who he is. This is very difficult then when you raise faith up, I think, to this level and talk about the true importance of faith. We need to speak accurately Jesus' words. We need to live faithfully Jesus' life. Of course, when we do that, it's going to continue to cause division in the world. That doesn't mean that there will be no division in the world because of that. But at least people would reject him or accept him based on the truth. So maybe you're here today and you need to accept Christ as Lord and to be baptized. Or perhaps accepting Jesus as Lord today in your life, like it means in my life, means that I need to recommit myself to living as Jesus lived. For all of us, this is a continual process. But the artist doesn't give up on us. The artist continues to hammer away. I imagine there are a lot of sparks flowing out under Christ's chisel as he's hammering on my life. Maybe you could kind of envision the same thing about your life. But will we yield? Will we, in faith, allow God to do the work in us that God wants to do to create the image of Christ? That's our prayer. Whether you've made that commitment before in your life and you would recommit yourself to it today, or you haven't stood up in public and said that in front of a group of believers. As we stand and sing, I ask each of us to commit ourselves to this today. And if you would like to come forward for prayer or for baptism, this would be your opportunity. Let's stand.